Tap your heels together 3 times. And think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. There's no place like home for Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, though it takes a long journey to figure that out. In a new book, our next guest says Dorothy is not alone. The concept of home is built into our brains. It's a big part of what makes us human. And it took us as a species a long journey to develop that attachment to home.
He says we can learn a lot about ourselves by looking at what home means to us and by paying more attention to the impact of homesickness and homelessness.
John S. Allen joins us now. He's a neuroanthropologist and research scientist at the University of Southern California, research associate in the Indiana University Department of Anthropology, and he's the author of the new book, Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem.
Well, I'm sure we could all think of the physical benefits of having shelter and maybe some nostalgia we associate with a house, but what does the concept of home look like to our brains?
Well, it's about feelings, really. When we say, and I really started working on this when I thought, what does it mean to say you feel at home? And these feelings that we have that are associated with home are not the great big emotions, you know, superlative joy or happiness or strong grief or sadness, at least when you have your home, but they're in the background, the comfort, security, the expectation that you'll be able to rest and recover from the world. And so I think that we build on those feelings which developed over millions and millions of years of evolution, combined with our sort of cultural propensity to build things and make stuff and to be organized into large groups and to associate with others in a place, and all that comes home emerges from all that stuff sort of mixing together.
And this is non-trivial. Emotions, we're learning as you write, emotions like this one, our attachment to home, they're a key part of how our brains work, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, without emotions, people think of emotion, often separate emotions as the sort of irrational side of you, and decision-making as this rational side, sort of Kirk and Spock-like, or a Star Trek reference.
Mm-hmm.
But really, emotions are essential to decision-making, to taking actions or not taking actions, and whether they're fully thought out. You know, we can have sort of below the conscious level that kind of reaction, but also even at a conscious level, it's an artificial separation really between emotion and rational thinking, between mind and body ultimately.
Well, there's one feeling, one emotion that you say we've really unfairly taken for granted, looked down on in the United States recently. Hasn't always been that way, and that's the feeling of homesickness. Why should we take homesickness more seriously?
Well, homesickness is telling you something, right? It's saying if you're separated from this place, this special place that you've developed a relationship with, and, of course, relationship with the others who may be in that same place, but just taking the place, that when it's gone, it causes a negative feeling. And some people have said it's akin to a mini grief. And we think of grief as coming in when you lose a significant person. But this mini grief of homesickness can be quite, for some people, quite debilitating, or at least in the short term. And one of the things that we clearly have in terms of our flexibility, our behavioral adaptability, is that if you've grown up in a sort of a home building environment, you have the ability to make your home again. So we are flexible enough to do that, but it may take some time, and we have to get over that loss. And I think homesickness is really just telling us home's important.
And you note that once upon a time in American culture, when we were a nation mostly of immigrants, people who came across an ocean maybe to get here, or people who would up stakes and go, I don't know, to the California Gold Rush or something, we talked about a homesickness. We wrote about it. It was a shared experience almost. Now we see it as a sign of weakness.
Yeah, I think it was sort of that homesickness in that sort of huge migrant way, where you really were, you'd go and you'd never come back. Communication was very limited. You put everything behind them, could be very devastating, and that was actually called nostalgia. But over time, that term kind of moved toward this sense of longing for a gone time or place that isn't really associated with homesickness in a personal way. But today, you know, when we expect, we sort of equate geographic mobility with upward mobility. And so you're supposed to be able to get out there and move, and you know, that's not as important as necessarily as moving up. Now, a lot of people don't move very far from where they're from, but in this upwardly mobile sort of sense of the American dream, really, or fulfilling it, you know, you put away the fact that you're leaving something behind.
Talking to John Allen, he's the author of the new book, Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. Well, John, why did our brains evolve to have this strong concept of home, this strong relationship with some kind of home base?
Well, I think it's sort of, and this gets back, this is sort of in the middle of my book, but if you start in the middle sometimes, you see how I went one way or the other. And in the middle of the book, I talk about, say, in the evolution, our human evolution, as a highly social species, as a species that's having children who have very large brains, and very large brains take a long time to grow up and to train. Not only that, part of what made us a different kind of ape, besides walking around on two legs at that time, 2 or 3 million years ago, was that we were likely having more than one child at a time, and chimps and gorillas do not. They have one at a time. And to do that, to train this large-brained child with maybe a sibling around as well, that relied on larger social groups, and partly was bringing fathers into the equation, not necessarily the direct Ozzie and Harriet sort of way of, hey, Dad, but that, you know, there's a sort of introduction of their support to raising these offspring, and then even broader than that, a social environment. And then on top of all that, related to it is sharing of food, and hunting, and also cooking of food, some people would say. So all these activities, which are feeding this sort of basic humanity, which in an anthropological or zoological sense is being an ape that walks on two legs with a big brain, all that's enhanced by having a place. And that place has been called a home base by archaeologists, but we could basically just call it home.
I think of some of our human ancestors, some fairly recent ones in the scope of evolution, as being wanderers, hunters and gatherers who go from place to place. Were they still, even though they were kind of on the move, were they still establishing these home bases that evolved into what we might think of as a home?
Well, as far as we can tell, I mean, partly is the archaeological record of these very flimsy structures that existed any time, but you know, before 20,000 years ago, are it's just very hard to interpret. One of the things that we do have is cave occupations. And our very close cousins, Neanderthals, clearly occupied caves as living spaces. And they also, and they've used them, you know, on an ongoing off, on and off basis. So clearly you can take with you home. Home doesn't mean being nailed to a certain spot, but it is going and establishing this sort of place from which to operate. And from which to recover, and you know, and from which to make plans.
In modern American culture, home's usually thought of as a house, the ideal being the American dream, the house that we own ourselves. Do you think we've developed too narrow of a vision, a concept of the meaning of home?
Well, I think so. I mean, in the book, I talk about looking at just some other animals. I talk about these Oregon pipe wasps, and we have them around my house here. And, you know, they make these mud nests that are on the wall, so they look like if enough of them get together, it's kind of annoying. But they cover the wall with these organ pipes. And that's really a narrow view. If your species is named after the thing you live in, then that's really a tight bound. And we're not called, you know, two-bedroom apartment apes. We have a wide variety of things that we live in, and we can call home, dwellings and domiciles or whatever you want to say. And that's why I sort of talk about in the book that I'm really interested in it from the inside out. I think if we look at it from within our brains and behavior, our psychology, you get a different view of what home is as opposed to just it being a house.
Hey, you cite a culture, Aboriginal culture in Australia, as their house is the desert, in effect, and they look at a European-style house and think that's a jail. That's basically a cage you've built for yourself. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a human-made structure.
No, I mean it's a structure that they've built. There's a cognitive structure, right? They've built that environment is transformed in their heads into something that is a domestic space, right? If we separated from wild and domestic. They control that space in a way that other cultures wouldn't.
So what I guess I'm hearing is we've got this genetic predisposition, this genetic desire, demand, really, to have a home space that our brain treats as a home, and then we learn in our culture what that is, what that's going to look like, what we have to do to build it.
Right, and I mean, it doesn't even have to be as strongly genetic that, but we are cultural, and we are have these feelings, we have these tendencies, and together all that kind of builds up into what we call sometimes a biocultural adaptation. And so I think it is very strong, these feelings that add up to feeling at home work together as a very adaptive thing for us as a species and for our ancestors, too.
Talking to John Allen. His new book is Home, How Habitat Made Us Human.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your experiences. What does home mean to you? Do you feel attached to your current house or apartment or maybe the one that you grew up in as home? Have you experienced homesickness in your life and how did it hit you? Call 800-642-1234 or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with John Allen. He's a neuroanthropologist and author of the new book, Home, How Habitat Made Us Human.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of when you think of home? Is it a building? Is it the people? Is it the memories? Have you ever been homesick or homeless? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. Ivy is on the line with us in Evansville. Ivy, hi.
Hi. I think of having a home as extremely adaptive, not just for humans, but for other animals, for wildlife. For example, if you were plopped in the middle of a city and you had to find food, it would take you a lot of time to find where you could, you know, shop or whatever. If you're living, our ancestors knew when things were available, there was a temporal aspect to it, and they knew where it was available. So if you have this place that you are familiar with, you can find food at different places and different times of the year, and you know where there's water, where it's safe. Maybe your dwelling is a place where you can sleep at night. And that's true for wildlife. I think they know where they're, for example, spotted owls know where their nest site is, and in the mating season, they get together, and it saves them time.
I want to jump in and get our guest's response. Thank you so much for that call, yeah. And she brings up a great point. So, but is there something different about the nests of wasps or the spotted owl's nest or the squirrel's nest that that is somehow conceptually different from our nests, our homes?
Well, partly, yes. I mean, yes and no. I mean, those things, like, and I talk about prairie dogs in the book as well. Certainly, those are providing shelter. They're an important place in the environment. It's a fixed point for them. What's interesting, as primates, you know, apes and monkeys are sort of neighborhood of the zoological world. We don't find that though. That is, actually building a structure, a home, whatever you want to call it, is virtually unique amongst all primates, and only the very most primitive prosimians nest in a hole, put their babies in a hole, these sort of little, not lemur-like, lorises, those sorts. Some of those will do that because they're nocturnal, and so they kind of hide out during the day. But that's about it for a kind of structured, protected life for primates. And so we come from that background of really non-builders, non-burrowers, non-anything like that. And then we emerge from it as people who generally, in 99% of the time, seek some sort of shelter and build it themselves. And so that's what makes us other animals certainly have this sort of habit, but amongst primates, it kind of reemerges in us sort of uniquely.
Ivy, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Todd in Madison. Todd, hi.
Hi. Hi. To me, the concept of home is more of like an area. Mm-hmm. As I travel around the country, I feel like when I get back into the Midwest, when I see the rolling hills of the Driftless, even if I'm not back in my home in Madison, I feel more at home with a bigger environment. So I don't really consider home like a specific place, but sort of like more region. I feel more at home in the region. Yeah.
Todd, that's really interesting. Thanks for bringing that up. So it's a familiar landscape, a home landscape for him in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of feeding on the same sort of familiarity and comfort and security that you can extend both. That's why I say it's not necessarily limited to a house or an apartment or anything like that. It's a conceptual thing. Now, some people may have a more expansive view of home, and others may really find it, you know, home is is this place, and home is this place with these people who are my family or my closest associates of some way. Might be your things, right? I think there's flexibility in there, and that's part of why we see it's kind of, I think, is a core sort of cognitive package that can tolerate a lot of this individual and cultural variation.
Todd, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to John Allen. His new book is Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. Before we get back to more callers, John, one thing you try to do, or you tease with some ideas of ways we could put this into practice, maybe in policy issues, maybe in our lives. And what I wanted to key on was homelessness. Given that, you know, if you're a homeless person, you're probably dealing with economic issues, trying to get a job. You might be dealing with mental health or substance abuse issues. Without that psychological grounding, that security of that home base, it seems like these problems might be more difficult to solve. And providing that space might be plan A, the first step towards solving those problems.
Yeah, I think it's important for everyone. I mean, for the people who are in that position, who are dependent on society in the broadest sense to alleviate their homelessness, I think it's important for everyone else to understand just how serious that is, that to be without a home is to, in some ways, not to be part of the society, at least temporarily or permanently. One of the things, just as a sort of side thing, I was looking at the reading the literature about stigma and brain imaging, so that in these sort of studies, I want to see what part of your brain lights up when you look at something that has a stigma or is disgusting or something. And just as an aside, they use homeless people as a stimulus for stigma or shame. Just some of these studies. I mean, it just shows how that is so strong in our view that someone like that actually loses some of their humanity. And so I think it's really important for everyone else who's not in that position to recognize that it isn't just being without a roof over your head when it's raining, but it's taking a lot more from them than that.
We'll go back to our callers now. Terry is with us in Berlin. Terry, hi.
Hi.
Hello.
What I wanted to say was I think home is more people than a place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm former military spouse. We moved our children 16 times.
Yep.
I viewed my job as making home for my family wherever we were.
Terry, thank you so much. So, John, it's even if you're not in the same place for a long time, we have apparently the capacity to create a new home.
Exactly. I think that's something you grow up in. And someone who works at that, you know, hard, that is trying to ensure that their family, despite these moves, is always maintaining a home feeling anyway, is doing a great service for their children when they're growing up. And we see the opposite of that, say, in children who get lost, you know, in a sort of revolving door foster care. And if they get stuck in that and age out of the system, never having really had a home, what you really are seeing later in life is an inability, probably an inability to actually build a home in a way that we all think of as productive. I mean, obviously you can learn, but it's really critical in this sort of younger age, developmentally, to understand and to learn to enjoy that feeling of home. And so I think that's exactly right. I think the relationships are one of the strongest things within a house, are one of the strongest things that define our feelings of home and our ability to reestablish that in a new place. The place, again, being less relevant than the relationships that it contains.
John, as we wrap up, what kind of lessons do you hope people take from what we know about our brains and our concept of home to improve our lives, to improve our relationship with our home, whatever that might look like?
Well, I think it's to get the essential relationships. And I think, you know, you see this tiny house movement, and then there's the whole tidy movement as well, people tidying, getting rid of the things that aren't important. And I think both of those sorts of things are sort of implicitly getting at the idea that, well, where you live, there's something else. There's something that's more important for being happy. There's something more important for making your home more useful for you. And if you get rid of extra space or extra things, maybe you can focus more on using the place of home for resting and restoring yourself, for thinking about how you're going to be when you're not at home. And so I do think those sorts of approaches, which may not be for everyone, certainly, are hinting at how we can make home better.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's neuroanthropologist John Allen. His new book is called Home, How Habitat Makes Us Human.